Thank y'all for coming back. If you'd like, go ahead and turn to Job chapter 1. Book of Job chapter 1. May not be having a Wednesday night class, but you're all invited down here tomorrow at midnight for our mass. I'll be standing in an empty room proving I don't know anything about the Bible. However, I do believe in the national holiday, so I hope you enjoy time with family and friends. But I certainly don't believe it is a national holy day. The Bible records the birth of Jesus, but it never commands us to set it aside as a separate day of worship. Simply not in the Scriptures. A lot of things are recorded, and we have to understand how to read them. But people taking the day off, getting together with family and friends, killing the fatted calf, and having a good time exchanging gifts with one another. Hope you enjoy your day. Look at Job chapter 1 tonight. And by the way, thank you, Jake. Good song service. Job 1. Let's read the first 12 verses. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. And that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and shunned evil. And 7 sons and 3 daughters were born to him. Also, his possessions were 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, very large household, so that this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. Now his sons would go and feast in their house, each on his appointed day, and would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. So it was, when the days of feasting had run their course, that Job would send and sanctify them. And he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "It may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus Job did regularly. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. And the Lord said to Satan, "From where do you come?" So Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth, and from walking back and forth on it." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him in all the earth, a blameless, upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil?" So Satan answered the Lord and said, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge around him, around his household, and around all that he has on every side? You blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But now, stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face." So the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your power. Only do not lay a hand on his person." Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. One of the oldest books of the Bible, and one of the books that is surrounded in mystery as far as when was it written? Who wrote the book? Questions we really don't have an answer to. There are some things that I think that come clear when we read the book. The book of Job is probably second in age when we consider the time period that it is covering. In other words, it reaches back the furthest into history. The book of Genesis is the only book that's older as far as the time frame that it covers. Some of the things that aren't in the book of Job, there's no reference to the Mosaic system. There's no reference to Jerusalem, no reference to anything that happened with Israel coming out of Egypt. Job seems to be written during the patriarchal period, where he is still the head of the household when it comes to religion. His wealth is measured in livestock and in possessions of servants and his animals, and that is the way that people like Abraham measured their wealth. So the book seems to suggest an earlier period than the law of Moses, probably written right around the time of Abraham. How the Jews came to call this an inspired book, we simply don't have all the answers to. And who wrote it? Again, we don't have any of the answers. Could Job have written it himself? He certainly could have. Jewish scholarship and tradition is all over the place. You name it, from Abraham to Moses to Ezra. Jews are not really sure who wrote the book. One of the things that some people seem to think about the book of Job is that Job was not a real historical figure, that it is an inspired book, but it's a story, it's a parable designed to teach us some lessons. A couple of things I would say to that. Number one, doesn't sound like Job was a figment of Jewish imagination when he praised Job's righteousness in Ezekiel chapter 14. And then, of course, the book of James, which we'll end with tonight, but in the book of James, James points to the perseverance of Job and treats Job as though he was a historical figure. And I heard one writer say that people who ask that question, it sounds right on the surface, but when you study Jewish history and Jewish literature, and when you study ancient literature as far back as you can go, particularly of the Hebrew variety, there's no such thing as the Jews making up historical people. And particularly when you get to chapter 38 and God begins to speak, no Jewish writer ever thought to actually put words in God's mouth, which is what the writer of Job would essentially be doing if Job didn't really exist. God didn't really confront a historical figure named Job and question him. If that didn't happen, then whoever wrote the book of Job is basically creating dialogue and putting it in the mouth of God. And that doesn't sound right. I think the more reasonable approach to the book of Job is this man lived. The things that happened to him actually happened to him. And they happened to him for the reasons that God said they happened. Now, for those of you who may not be familiar, we're going to skip over what actually happens to Job. But messengers keep coming back to Job after Satan went out from the presence of the Lord, and guess what they said? One by one, all of your possessions are gone. And oh, by the way, those seven sons and three daughters that you love, they were gathered in a house one day. Big wind came along, turned the house on them, and all 10 children are dead. Job, you've lost everything. Everything in the blink of an eye, and you've lost your 10 children. Of course, what we did read was Satan's accusation. Here's Job, blessed of God, got all the kinds of things with which we would say a man is blessed. But Satan, the accuser, the great accuser, says, well, does he fear you for nothing? If you take it all away, will he still be faithful to you? Satan is guessing that Job won't. God says Job will. And we know, most of us, how the story ends. After everything has been removed from Job, look at Job's response in verse 20. Then Job arose, tore his robe, shaved his head, and fell to the ground and worshipped. And he said, naked I came from my mother's womb. Naked I shall return there. The Lord gave, Lord, it's taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. In all this, Job did not sin nor charge God with wrong. It's hard to get your mind around somebody that could say something like that when you really consider what's actually happened to him. Chapter 2, Satan presents himself before God again. God brings up Job once again. Have you considered my servant Job? Notice Satan's response in chapter 2. Look at verse 4. So Satan answered the Lord, and he said, skin for skin. Yes, all that a man has, he will give for his life. But stretch out your hand now, and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will surely curse you to your face. So the Lord said to Satan, behold, he is in your hands, but spare his life. Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with painful boils, from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took for himself a potsherd with which to scrape himself while he sat in the midst of the ashes. Then his wife said to him, do you still hold to your integrity? Curse God and die. But he said to her, you speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God, and shall we not accept adversity? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. Again, incredible integrity under in unimaginable conditions. By the way, the condition is known as elephantitis, I think they called it. About the most feared thing in the Far East that somebody could have. If you keep reading the book, you get insight into it. It's not stated in any one passage, but as you continue to read the book of Job, passage here and a passage there lets you know that he was unrecognizable. They didn't even know what he couldn't even believe they were looking at Job when his three friends came to see him. All of his wealth gone, blink of an eye. 10 children wiped out, blink of an eye. In a blink of an eye, Job has the most dreaded disease anyone can have. And yet, those are the responses of Job. Now, if we keep reading, Job has three friends that hear about his adversity. His three friends are named Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. They come to comfort him. They hear about the tremendous difficulties that have fallen upon Job, so they come to comfort him. But it's kind of interesting what Job says to them after they're done talking to him. What I like in chapter 3 is, you know what they did for the first 7 days when they came to sit with Job? Nothing. They sat with him for 7 days silent. That was them at their best. If they had only remained silent, they probably could have been a great comfort to Job. But by the time they got done comforting him, Job said things like this. Chapter 14, verse 1, Job said, "No doubt you are the people, and wisdom will die with you." We were talking about humor in the Bible last Tuesday night. There's a good example of it. Job's being humorous, as though these men are the only ones known for wisdom. Well, the fact is, they're not very wise. Chapter 14, or I think that was chapter 12, excuse me. Chapter 14, one of my favorite verses from the book of Job. "Man who's born of a woman is a few days and full of trouble." And then chapter 16, I believe it's verse 2, Job calls his friends miserable comforters. Are you all? Why would he call three friends that care enough about him to trek a long distance to get to him so that they can try to comfort him? Why would he call them miserable comforters? Because they don't know who God is. And that's one of the whole problems with people who do not understand God, and one of the reasons why doctrine is important. Do you know what doctrine really is? Doctrine is properly understanding who God is. And something as simple as trying to comfort somebody at a time of enormous loss, you can even manage to mess that up if you don't understand who God is. And Job's three friends didn't understand who God is. Now, what is the debate going on? There's actually two. One thing you always need to remember about the book of Job is chapters 1 and 2, which we've just read from. God and Satan know about that. Job and his three friends have no idea that's taken place. They have no idea the conversation that God and Satan have had in chapters 1 and 2, the accusations that Satan has made. And by the way, keep that in mind. After Job's initial response to his family and his possessions being gone, what an incredible response. Chapter 2, Satan presents himself back in front of God. Did you notice what Satan didn't do? Satan didn't say, "You know what, God? Guess you were right about Job." What a man. No, he didn't say that at all. He came back with another accusation. And I guarantee you, I don't know what it would have been, but if there was a chapter 3 where Satan presented himself in front of God again and Job's name came up, he'd have come back with a third accusation, because he never stops. He is the great adversary. No matter what is going on, he will try to twist it every time. He does not quit. Revelation chapter 20, what is Gog and Magog? You want to know what Gog and Magog is? It's the spiritual warfare that we fight that comes at us from every angle of every day of every hour. It never stops. And it's not going to stop. It's one of the reasons we need to put on the whole armor of God, because that is how relentless the adversary, who always accuses us, that's how he operates. But anyways, that's the debate that's going on in heaven. What is Satan's accusation? Does he serve you for nothing? But on earth, the problem is Job and his three friends don't understand why this is happening either. And they have a false view of God. Even Job has it. Here's the false view. God punishes evil in the here and now. God rewards goodness in the here and now. Job, we don't know what it is you've done, but you've obviously done something to deserve all of this misery that's come upon you. Why don't you confess it? And maybe God will shine his countenance upon you again. Meanwhile, here's Job, who really thinks the same way. His problem now is, I haven't done anything. I don't know why this is happening to me, but I'm telling you, I'm innocent. His three friends aren't treating him like he's innocent. Confess, Job. That's why he calls them miserable comforters. But that's the debate that's going on earth. Does God punish or reward in the here and now? Job and his three friends have no idea. Solomon hasn't written yet. But one of the things that Solomon said that touches to this, he said, the race is not always to the swift, nor the battle to the strong. Time and chance happens to them all. When we read the Old Testament, we can see that God does judge nations in the here and now. But he doesn't judge individuals in the here and now. Job and his three friends don't understand that. And so they're trying to work out what's going on. Now back to the argument that's going on in heaven. The man that originally brought me to church, I remember profoundly him saying something one day that touches on the book of Job and the argument of Satan. He wasn't referring to Job or Satan. He said this. He said, godliness is an indirect form of selfishness. Let me say that again. Godliness is an indirect form of selfishness. Now, why would he say such a thing? What he was thinking was that mankind is only good to God and to our fellow man because we look for a reward. And hence, it's self-centered. Same argument Job's making. And there's some truth, or I should say, that's a statement worth looking at. The book debates this subject by examining the idea that God's blessings or curses can be seen are a direct result of God's favor or his lack thereof. That's what they're debating. Job can't believe all these curses have come upon him because he knows in his heart of hearts that he hasn't done anything. So, in other words, is man capable of being righteous without an immediate reward? And that's kind of the question that is being debated, or that Satan introduces, that's part of what's being debated here. Now, Job's trust is kind of hard to get your mind around. I had a discussion one day with my best friend and his wife, who's as articulate as any preacher ever thought about being. I mean, she's one sharp cookie. But one of the things she said about the story of Job, that I still can't get my mind around those 10 children that died, even though he restored 10 more at the end of the book. What about those 10? She could never get her mind around the fact that they were gone now and the pain that that would cause. But be that as it may, it is still hard to get your mind around somebody that's gone through what Job has gone through and uttered the statements that he uttered. Can you imagine sitting in Job's seat, having that happen to you, and imagining what you would say in response? What would you say? I'll tell you, one man had a similar situation. A guy by the name of Horatio Spafford. He was born in 1828, and he died in 1888. He was a lawyer from Chicago. Now, be careful when you hear that somebody was a lawyer. Insert lawyer joke here. You know what the truth is about lawyers? They're like any other profession. I don't care what the profession is. You know what a lawyer is? Or the profession of lawyers are? There's one part of lawyers that are evil. Addicted to evil. There's a large group of lawyers who are very decent, but their moral scale is somewhat flexible, depending on what's going on. Shall we do evil that good may come? They work out games like that. But there are also very few and noble, righteous ones. They got into the law for all the right reasons and hold their integrity no matter what's going on. And you can apply that principle to any profession under the sun. So all the lawyer jokes aside, this Chicago lawyer, Horatio Spafford, was a pretty honorable one. He was married to his soulmate. The article I read said he was married to his soulmate. And I thought, what does that mean? You know, tell me the story about a soulmate. He never did, but I thought, oh, okay, he's married to a soulmate, as opposed to Nicole, who had to pick me up on the side of the road. I'm making a joke, but here's the joke. Brethren, isn't that one of the most precious things in life, is to have married somebody that you feel in your bones? It was divine intervention that you be together. And you know that, and you feel that. Wouldn't you feel blessed? Yeah. Four daughters and one son. So he had his soulmate, and he had four daughters and one son. He also, in Chicago, owned a lot of property. So this added, obviously, to his net worth and to his social status in the community. He's the kind of man that if we looked at, we would say, blessed. Look at him. He's blessed of God. But what a difference a day makes. It's one of the reasons why we need to be careful. You get all your ducks lined up, guess what happens? It's part of what I was talking about this morning, tempting the Lord. Just about the time we get all of our ducks lined up, guess what happens? Lord shakes the heavens and the earth, and suddenly our ducks aren't in a row anymore. That's what happened to Horatio. Then came 10:8 through 10:10, 1871. That was the Great Chicago Fire, which wiped out all of his properties. Still married to his soulmate, still a practicing lawyer, but right after that his son died. His one and only son. 2 years later, now think about that, 1871, his son dies. Chicago Fire destroys all of his properties. But he's still got a wife, still got four daughters. He's still a practicing lawyer. But it's been a pretty rough 2 years. So he puts his daughters on a ship and sends them, and his wife and his daughters on a ship and sends them on a European vacation just to get them out of Chicago for a while and the difficulties that they've been living with. Gets a telegram. You know what the telegram says? Make sure I wrote it in my notes. Let me make sure what it says here. His wife sent him a telegram while she was supposedly in Europe. I alone survived. What should I do? The rest of the telegram reveals that when his wife and his daughter sailed on that ship to Europe, it crashed. All four of his daughters are dead. But his wife has survived. That's 3 years in the life of Horatio Spafford. He went from the top of the mountain in Chicago to all of his possessions are gone, his son's dead, his four daughters are dead, and his wife is in Europe begging him to come so that he can bury his four daughters. Now think about that for a minute. You got to get on a ship and sail across the Atlantic Ocean before you can take care of business. A lot of time on your mind, on your hands. What kind of thoughts are running through your mind as you get on that ship? Horatio recorded the thoughts that were on his mind and the words that he was thinking. Do you know what they are? Here's what he said. When peace like a river attendeth my way, when sorrows like sea billows roll, whatever my lot thou hast taught me to say, it is well with my soul. Can I just hear that somewhere, Jake? Horatio Spafford, if you didn't notice in that song that we just sang, he's the author of those lyrics. He didn't write the melody. But when the melody maker heard his story and saw those lyrics, he put that song to a melody, and we sing it to this day. Sounds like a man that's read Job. Sounds like a man that was well acquainted with what the book of Job says. Remember something about times of extreme adversity. Adversity's temptation is this. It tends to give us license. Job said something interesting in chapter 6, verse 26. Job said this. After he has been rebuked by Eliphaz, Job says this, Do you intend to rebuke my words and the speeches of a desperate one, which are as the wind? Yes, you overwhelm the fatherless and undermine your friend. What does he mean, whose speeches are as the wind? You know what he's saying right there? He's saying, cut me some slack. I can't believe you're attacking me. Did you not notice what I'm going through? Give me a little space here. Now, why did his three friends get mad at his speech? Look what Job said in chapter 3. After his three friends sit with him for 7 days, Job finally opens up his mouth. Notice what he says. Verse 1, chapter 3. After this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. And Job spoke and said, may the day perish on which I was born, and the night in which it was said, a male child is conceived. Drop down to verse 11. Why did I not die at birth? Why did I not perish when I came from the womb? Now look at verse 20. Why is light given to him who is in misery, and life to the bitter of soul, who long for death, but it does not come, and search for it more than hidden treasures? Job certainly didn't curse God, but he cursed the day of his own birth. That's how much misery he was in. And oh, by the way, a little sidebar. Look at verse 21 again. Who long for death, but it does not come, and search for it as more than hidden treasures. You know what I wrote down next to that passage? Dr. Kevorkian. And I'm dead serious. Job, if you're in such misery and you want cursing the day of your death, why don't you just kill yourself? Did you notice that as much misery as Job is in, he still recognizes that his life, as much as he wished it would end, isn't his to take? Somehow, some way, in all this misery, Job recognizes there must be something going on. I don't understand. I hate it here. I curse the day of my birth. I don't curse God, but I curse this misery that I'm in. There's a similar passage in chapter 6, but I always remember that passage whenever I'm hearing the euthanasia and mercy killing debate. Job didn't think he had a right to take his own life, and neither should we. But he certainly was in misery. But remember, sometimes we allow our temptations to give us license. For instance, you ever heard somebody say, you know, my boss like a slave master, and my job is a dead-end job? You know why a lot of people say that? Because they're in the office supply cabinet raiding it, justifying taking all the office supplies home because my boss is like a slave master. You ever heard the phrase, if you had my wife, you'd drink too? Yeah, people say things like those all the time. My husband abuses me both verbally and physically. Might be true. But you shall not commit adultery. You notice how often people use adversity as a license to do things they ought not do? Even Job said some things he probably shouldn't have said. And when his friends confronted him, what did he say? You need to cut me some slack. And guess what? I do believe that at a time like that, probably should cut Job a little slack. But by the same token, it never gives us license. In our lives, just like in Job's, we have no idea why God is allowing us to pass through the valley of the shadow of death. We don't understand. And we don't need to be nice sometimes, understand why I got to go through this. But we need to trust in the Lord that there is a reason why we are going through the valley of shadow of death. But even so, I shall not be moved. Verse 2. Of the song we just sang tonight. To refresh your memory, Horatio writes, my sin, oh the bliss of this glorious thought, my sin, not in part, but the whole, is nailed to the cross, and I bear it no more. Praise the Lord, oh my soul. Think about this passage from 2 Peter chapter 3. It's pretty famous to all of us. 2 Peter chapter 1, I'm sorry. But I'm going to start in 2 Peter chapter 1 and verse 5. Famous passage, you all will remember it. If you want to turn, you can. 2 Peter 1, verse 5. Here's what Peter said. But also for this very reason, give all diligence. Add to your faith virtue, and to virtue knowledge, to knowledge self-control, to self-control perseverance, to perseverance, godliness, to godliness, brotherly kindness, and to brotherly kindness, love. For if these things are yours and abound, you will be neither barren nor unfruitful in the knowledge of our Lord Jesus Christ. Here's the key verse. For he who lacks these things is short-sighted, even to blindness, and has forgotten that he was cleansed from his old sins. If those Christian graces, as we call them, don't abound in your life, you know what that's proof of? When you're looking backwards, you don't seem to see as clearly as you used to. I've told you the story before, but this is an appropriate moment. First time I met the man that converted me, he said to me, "You look like you don't feel too good." And I said, "I don't." And he said, "Good. I hope you never forget how you feel." And he walked away, and I thought, I'm never talking to that man again. Ouch, that hurt. What a mean thing to say. You know what he was telling me? He was telling me to keep it green, Mike. You always need to remember what you have been washed away from. Keep it green. Remember what it's like to be freshly washed from the sinful life that you used to live. You need to be able to remember that, Mike, because if you don't remember it, maybe it's because you haven't stopped yet. You need to remember that. And so I've always lived by those words, and I thought about one day, you ever notice the peculiar answer that Jesus gave to Peter? On the night Peter's about to make the darkest sin of his life, you got to know that in Peter's life, the thing he's the most ashamed of is the night Jesus was betrayed. He denied knowing him. You got to know that. That in Peter's life, it was never worse than that moment. I find it interesting that when Jesus told him he was going to do that, rather than just say, "Oh, by the way, Peter, before the night ends, you will have denied me." He didn't say that. He said, "Before the rooster crows, you will have denied me." Peter denied him for the third time. What did he hear? What did Peter think of the rest of his life when he heard a rooster crow? Do you think the Lord sat up in heaven and said, "Oh, I wished I hadn't said it to him that way. Now I've cursed him. He's got to think about that dark day every time he hears a rooster crow." No, that's the exact reason why Jesus said it to him. So that for the rest of his life, when Peter thought about, heard a rooster crow, guess what he would remember? "Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed, lest he fall." We have to be careful because guess what? No matter what we're going through, we need to remember, thank you, God, for your amazing grace in saving a wretch like me. That's just as true when you're having a baby and feeling blessed. It's just as true when you're burying your baby and feeling cursed. Apparently, Horatio remembered that when he was sailing to England to bury his children. And the last thing I want us to think about is Horatio's third verse. "And Lord, haste the day when my faith shall be sight, and the clouds be rolled back as a scroll. The trump shall resound, and the Lord shall descend. Even so, it is well with my soul." As he was on that ship sailing to England to bury his four daughters after just having buried his son and lost all his property, he still remembered what we were talking about this morning. He still focused on heaven and the fact that he could be reunited with his children. In times of adversity, it is so easy for people to say, "Why me? Lord, why me?" People say that all the time. You know what's a better question to ask? Why not me? Why not me? Why should it always be somebody else? Why not me? I've heard people say that, I know God won't give me more than I can handle. I just wished He wouldn't trust me so much. Do you think Job felt like God gave him more than he could handle? But what was God's ultimate reason for doing it? It's to prove what an incredibly righteous character Job was. And to show you how to get through times of adversity. When times of adversity come upon us, is when we need more than ever to show other people this is how a Christian handles adversity. Deep, agonizing adversity. Suffering and gratitude are not incompatible. When I was a younger man, I didn't think you could be happy and sad at the same time. I grew up and found out I was wrong. You can be going through tremendous adversity and still have a heart of gratitude, which it is well with my soul helps us to see. Be careful when it comes to words like depression. Anybody else ever feel depressed from time to time? Yeah. All of us do we not? Some of us have gotten a diagnosis. Depressed. Medical community even calls you depressed. Be careful. One of the things that scares me when I see Christians going to the world, highly educated, dedicated world, but going to the world for diagnoses and help and struggling with their depression and their issues. One of the things that scares me is, does the person who's counseling you understand life? Do you recognize that there is a certain amount of restlessness and discontentedness in the life of all Christians that is not only healthy, but it's there for a reason. It's to push us onward. Did you ever notice how the book of Exodus begins? Israel are heroes. Joseph has saved Egypt from starvation. He's invited his family of 70 to come live in Egypt. Joseph is the greatest hero in all of Egypt. The Israelites are celebrated because Joseph saved them from starvation. They're heroes. God didn't call them out of Egypt then. God waited until there arose a king in Egypt that didn't know Joseph. And suddenly Israel's gone from being heroes to being slaves. And suddenly their groanings have come up before God and God moves against Egypt. Had God moved against Egypt when Israel was still a hero, guess what Israel would have said? Who needs a land flowing with milk and honey? I like it right here. When God called them to a land flowing with milk and honey, they couldn't wait to get out of Egypt. Now, they didn't get to Israel, but they couldn't wait to leave because they were in misery. There's a certain amount of discontentedness, irritability, and not feeling at home that shouldn't be clinically diagnosed and done away with. It should be the Christian accepting that I live in a war zone and sometimes horrible things happen and I go through seasons of adversity, but I got something better waiting for me. C.S. Lewis talked about when he was a kid, he grew up and there was a mountain outside his window. He said, mountains stopped me longing. And I never understood that for the longest time until Nicole and I drove out here and going through Arizona, there was a mountain in the window. It's a beautiful mountain. We were on a beautiful road, went down. You could see the mountain for miles. But we got to talking, and I looked up a half hour later, and guess what? The mountain's still out there. It looks like we haven't got to it yet. Well, how long is this mountain going to be right there? Seems like we never passed the mountain. It was always right there. It's teaching you longing. Almost like you're never going to get there. And then suddenly you do. That is what life on earth is like. God gives us hints that there's something better and something that will satisfy that restlessness, that irritability. No more seasons of adversity. It is out there. But sometimes you got to go through the adversity to get there. And whatever my lot, God has taught me to say, it is well with my soul. I'll leave you with two passages. First of all, Jim referred to it this morning. Remember those profound words in Philippians chapter 4, verse 11. Paul said, "Not that I speak in regard to need, for I have learned in whatever state I am to be content. I know how to be abased and I know how to abound. Everywhere and in all things I have learned both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me." Learned how to be abased and learned how to abound. You know what the key word is there? He learned. Guess what? We don't need to learn to be happy when we're abounding. We need to learn to be happy when we're not. When we're in jail. When we're going through seasons of adversity. And then one last passage. Don't ever forget that James talked about Job. You know what James said in chapter 5? Verse 11, he said, "Indeed, we count them blessed who endure. Have you heard of the perseverance of Job and seen the end intended by the Lord, that the Lord is very compassionate and merciful?" Why is it when we talk about Job, we always talk about chapters 1 and 2? Anybody read chapter 42? Every blessing Job had came back to him double. That was the end intended by the Lord. After the Lord used Job to prove to Satan that some people will serve me whether times are good and whether times are bad. They will serve me in rain. They will serve me in sunshine. They will serve me when things are coming their way. They will serve me when things are leaving them. They will serve me regardless of circumstances. And Job is one of them. How about you? Are you one of them? If you've never given your life to Jesus Christ, have you heard about the end intended for Job? The same end is intended for you. To be blessed forever and ever. And to never know anymore what a season of adversity is. If you need to come or you need to come back. He that believes and is baptized shall be saved. Why don't you come now as we sing the song Jake has chosen.